Bonjour, ce podcast est l'enregistrement de la soirée de lancement du livre 0 plus 1, Femmes, numérique et technoculture, écrit par Sadie Plante et publié aux éditions Sans Soleil en 2026. C'était le 4 mars 2026, à Préambule, juste à côté de la librairie La Dispersion. La Dispersion, c'est une librairie qui propose une sélection d'ouvrages d'art et de pensée critique depuis 2015. Elle se trouve à la place des Grottes, numéro 1, vers la gare de Genève. L'ouvrage 0 plus 1 a été publié initialement en 1995 et traduit en français pour la première fois en 2026. Sadie Plante y propose une contre-histoire du lien entre genre et technologie. Croisant critique sociale, cyberculture et écriture spéculative, l'ouvrage est un texte pionnier et constitutif du courant cyberféministe, révélant le rôle essentiel mais effacé des femmes dans l'informatique, d'Ada Lovelace aux programmeuses anonymes. Par sa forme expérimentale et son approche théorique, le livre explore le potentiel libérateur de la cyberculture pour transformer les rapports de pouvoir et d'identité. Nous avons eu la chance d'accueillir l'autrice Sadie Plante en personne, ainsi que Cindy Coutant et Oriane Pettoni, qui ont toutes deux écrit un texte pour le livre. On y parle en français et en anglais, il n'y a pas de traduction. Le montage a été réalisé par Ralas Charara et la discussion est modérée par moi-même, Ramaya Teguigné. Pour cet événement, nous avons reçu le soutien de la République et Canton de Genève. On commence par les présentations des intervenantes.
Donc Oriane Pettoni, je me suis occupée de la postface et donc je suis docteur en philosophie et puis aussi diplômée en histoire de l'art et art plastique. Voilà.
Je suis Cindy Coutant et j'ai écrit la préface de ce livre iconique. Et je suis aussi artiste et chercheuse et je m'occupe d'un bachelor à la aide qui s'appelle Drama. Voilà.
Ok, et moi, je suis Sadie. J'ai écrit le livre. Je voudrais parler en français ce soir, mais mon concept, c'est ça marche pour les commissions et pour discuter avec les voisins à Bienne. J'habite à Bienne. Bienne, c'est bilingue. Malheureusement, je parle l'autre langue, suisse-allemand. Ouais, peut-être je parle en anglais. Mais je comprends le français assez bien. J'espère. Ça marche. Merci.
Moi, je m'appelle Léa, je fais partie des éditions Sans Soleil et j'ai fait le graphisme aussi du livre et des maquettes de nos collections.
Donc, je vais vous lire le préambule. C'était le temps où nous flottions, à perte de mer. Il me semble que c'était hier. Espèce, sexe, race, classe. En ce temps-là, rien de tout cela n'avait de sens. Ni parents, ni enfants. Rien que nous, chaînes insécables de sœurs, chaleureuses et humides, indiscernables l'une de l'autre, magnifiques d'indistinction, débridées et fusionnelles. Pas de génération, pas de futur, pas de passé. Un plan géographique sans fin, de quanta pulsatile, de micro-maillage, de toile d'interaction sans limite, de mélange, de suintement, de fusion, s'entremêlant à travers nous, tournant en cercle les unes autour des autres. Irréfléchie, inutile, sans but, insouciante, inconsciente, déchaînée. Pli et pliage, plié et multiplié, plissement et réplique. Nous n'avions aucune démarcation, aucun but, aucun moyen de nous distinguer. Nous étions ce que nous faisions, quand nous le faisions. Libre-échange, microprocessus finement régulé, transfert polymorphe se riant des frontières et des limites, il n'y avait rien à quoi se raccrocher, rien à saisir, rien à protéger ou dont se protéger. Les intérieurs et les extérieurs n'avaient aucune importance. Nous ne pensions pas à de telles choses. Nous ne pensions à rien du tout. Tout s'offrait alors à nous. Nous n'y prêtions pas attention. Tout était gratuit. Il en avait été ainsi pour des dizaines, des milliers, des millions, des milliards de ce qui serait défini ensuite comme des années. Si nous y avions réfléchi, nous aurions dit que cela durerait indéfiniment, ce monde fluent et fluide. Et puis, il nous arriva quelque chose. Le climat changea. Nous ne pouvions plus respirer. Il se mit à faire terriblement froid, bien trop froid pour nous. Tout ce que nous touchions était empoisonné. Des gaz nocifs et des airs toxiques raréfiés envahirent notre zone océanique. Certaines ont dit que nous en étions responsables, que notre activité s'était retournée contre nous, que nous avions détruit notre environnement par un accident que nous avions provoqué. Il y eut des rumeurs de trahison et de sabotage, des murmures au sujet d'une invasion extraterrestre et de mutants venus d'un autre vaisseau. Seules certaines d'entre nous ont survécu à la rupture. Les conditions étaient si éprouvantes que beaucoup, parmi celles qui s'en sont sorties, auraient préféré mourir. Nous avons muté au point d'en être méconnaissables, à nos propres yeux, nous assemblant en unité d'un type qui, comme tout le reste, avait auparavant été impensable. Nous nous sommes retrouvés à travailler comme rouages serviles de systèmes dont la complexité et l'échelle nous échappaient. Étions-nous leurs parasites ? Étaient-ils les nôtres ? Quoi qu'il en soit, nous sommes devenus des composantes de notre propre emprisonnement. En pratique, nous avions disparu. Et le préambule se termine avec une citation de Sun Zi, L'art de la guerre. Infiniment mystérieux, il occulte toute forme. Suprêmement divin, il ne laisse échapper aucun bruit. C'est ainsi que le parfait chef de guerre se rend maître du destin de l'adversaire.
Alors, moi, je vais juste introduire et vous parler de la maison d'édition de Sans Soleil, de notre collection, comment ce livre il s'inscrit. Dans notre ligne éditoriale, comme ça pour donc en Sans Soleil, on a trois collections, une de théorie critique, une de théorie esthétique et une autre de fiction et poésie. Et on s'attache à traduire des livres qui traitent de critique sociale, d'études des machines, de supermétiers, de science-fiction. Et ça fait beaucoup de sens avec les éléments qui sont traités dans le CCRU dont tu faisais partie. Le CCRU, pour ceux qui ne connaissent pas, c'est le Cybernetic Culture Research Unit. Et donc, c'était un labo de recherche qui existait dans les années 90 à Londres, à l'université de Warwick. C'est des thématiques qui s'inscrivent dans notre ligne. Et du coup, pour nous, ça faisait sens d'avoir ton livre traduit dans cette collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ok. C'est bon avec la langue, quand je parle anglais. Je m'excuse. It's a real pleasure to be here. And they're quite amazing to see this book translated into French after nearly 30 years. You know, when I hear you read this out, it sounds much nicer in French, I think, actually, than in English. But most things do, so. But I think, wow, it's like, really 30 years since I wrote that, especially if you add on a few years for the publication time. I think it really is probably 30 years ago. 30 years is a long time. A lot has changed. A lot of the fundamental questions seem to remain the same, however, and I think that's why there is a lot of interest in this book at the moment, not only with this translation, but I've noticed other discussions of it happening as well. I think probably one of the reasons is that many of the issues that we're now so concerned about around, especially in relation to artificial intelligence, many of these issues were discussed in the 1990s in relation to artificial intelligence, but more generally in relation to what we then call the digital revolution. And hard as it is to imagine, of course, the internet was relatively new at this time. mobile phones had yet to appear. I mean, imagine. So in these ways, it really is a very long time ago in kind of technological time, as we might say. But yeah, as I say, many of the big questions remain, and people are still, of course, we're still concerned about issues around, you know, what does artificial intelligence, for example, do to our creativity, to notions of our originality, all these issues around authenticity, they come up again and again and again. Questions about the borders or not between the human and the machine, or between the artificial and the natural, and what is intelligence? All of these questions are, you know, still around and still very relevant. And especially the need to subvert and resist what even then in the 1990s seemed to be the goals of much technological development, which were, of course, as we all know, mainly to do with the military, with control, with surveillance, a kind of drive towards standardization, order, conformism, the whole kind of reinforcement of the Western worldview. And obviously, zeros and ones, and many of the texts that were written at that time were attempts to interrupt, disturb, subvert this tendency. Today, we could say that, you know, these didn't really work, because we now find ourselves living with what were many of the worst nightmares that we had in the 1990s that really have come true. Right, I'm thinking from the way in which our everyday options for communication are increasingly limited to a certain few platforms run by a certain few corporations. I say limited, even perhaps determined, we might say. And yeah, right from that kind of our everyday experience here in a city like this, right through to the use of the technology for ever more authoritarian and violent and cynical exercises of military power. So yeah, as I say, zeros and ones in a way was an attempt to kind of ward off this future and propose some other histories and some other possible directions. In this respect, yeah, it obviously didn't really work. What it did do, I think, at the time was to, of course, encourage women in particular to have a sense of connection, even a kind of affinity with the technology. This might sound like a small thing today, but in the 1990s, there was this real feeling. I mean, people often talked about computers as toys for the boys. And fortunately, this does sound like, you know, very out of date now. But it was an intervention into that kind of atmosphere. It was also an attempt to expose and bring out women's role in the infrastructure of the technology, and also the importance of the infrastructure itself in the history of the technology. And an attempt not, of course, just to add a few prominent female figures to an already existing history, as, you know, a lot of feminists, the history does, you know, you kind of have the history of, let's say, I don't know, art history, and then you find the forgotten women and you insert them in, and then, like, we feel we've achieved something. I mean, it does achieve something, but maybe not so much. But what I really tried to do was insert these figures, and in doing so, to tell a different kind of history, to really change the story itself, and not just add us, if you like, to the existing story. So in this sense, the book is full of kind of twists and turns and non-linearities, and a lot of discussion about unintended consequences. And of course, it's given expression in a kind of non-linear form. And if I'm honest, it's probably this form and the way the book is written that I still most like about it myself. I still think it's like the most valuable aspect of the book. Some of its themes, of course, are very dated, obviously. As I said, it's a long time ago. I think some of the strategies it uses are also dated. For example, its suggestion that, in effect, power will inevitably be undermined by what it thinks are the tools in its service. This is the kind of the line the book really pushes in a kind of propagandist way. At the time, I think it was a really kind of powerful and useful, quite inspiring, even empowering kind of suggestion. But now, probably I would rather say that there is no inevitability of that happening, but there's no inevitability on either side. There just is no inevitability at all. So there's no kind of guarantee that something more emancipatory or egalitarian or frankly just more pleasurable and fun will come out of where we are now. But at the same time, there's also no guarantee that the kind of patriarchal warmongers that we are now suffering under will win either. So neither side have this inevitability. And maybe now I would say, combating these narratives of inevitability is actually in itself quite an important thing to do. But there's still quite a lot about the book's kind of provocative and quite cheeky and a bit propagandist style that I think still can unsettle and unnerve those who think they have everything under control. And undermining those people is probably more important now than it ever has been, or certainly in our lifetimes. And yeah, I just hope the book can still be useful and inspiring to all the people who are trying to undermine their power. Yeah.
Ben, peut-être que je vais raconter comment je suis arrivée à ton livre, parce que c'est une chose qui s'est faite il y a très 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 longtemps. Puis la manière dont j'ai abordé la préface, c'était peut-être de donner des clés de lecture pour comprendre pourquoi ce livre est extrêmement utile et pourquoi ce livre a complètement réussi quelque chose, en fait, je crois, pour comprendre un peu la situation actuelle, en fait. En fait, pour n'importe qui s'intéresse à des questions liées à la technologie, vraiment, ce livre est absolument indispensable, iconique. C'est l'un des premiers livres qu'il faut lire. En tout cas, c'est une conviction que j'ai. C'est comme ça qu'il m'est arrivé dans les mains. Mais voilà, c'est une évidence que je vous donne maintenant. Parce que, en fait, il revient à la fois sur une histoire de la technologie qui est complètement méconnue, qui a été complètement effacée pour des raisons patriarcales, impérialistes, des raisons bien connues. Mais aussi que, finalement, il revient presque en creux sur ce mythe, en fait, de la technologie qui est absolument un mythe. Un mythe d'une histoire qui tombe du ciel, qui est la destinée du monde blanc, qui est la destinée de l'Occident, la destinée de l'Empire occidental, et qui amène cet inévitable dont tu parles comme un espèce de rouleau compresseur où tout ce qui doit être produit, il n'y a pas d'alternative, there is no alternative, un slogan bien connu de Thatcher, mais qui ne cesse de nous hanter. Et les choses ne peuvent pas en être autrement, en fait. Et donc, la chose qui est assez folle quand on ouvre ce livre, c'est ce nombre de chapitres, donc 75. Quand j'écrivais la préface, j'étais là, OK, il faut que j' ai une vision d'ensemble. Et j'ai fait la liste des chapitres en essayant de comprendre en une phrase... c'est quoi les questions, etc., etc. Et c'était... En fait, à la fin, j'y voyais pas du tout plus clair. Et c'est ça, je pense, la force du livre. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a une sorte de puissance aussi, de joie d'ouvrir toutes ces possibles qui sont en fait une histoire, finalement, qui est liée à la technique, en fait, et beaucoup moins à la technologie, qui est un ensemble de possibles liés à une manière de se relier au monde, qui est toujours processuel, qui n'est pas du tout lié à une forme d'efficacité, qui n'est jamais lié à une forme de cannibalisation ou de dévoration, qui est toujours en fait une espèce de négociation dans un temps et dans un espace, et c'est toujours une histoire qui est extrêmement située. Et le mythe de la technologie, à l'inverse, nous dit complètement autre chose, c'est-à-dire qu'il n'y a pas de situation, il n'y a pas de corps, il n'y a pas de terre, il n'y a pas de conséquences à ce que l'on fait, et on avance. Et c'est ça qui nous mène là où on est aujourd'hui. Et donc, dans la séquence qu'on est en train de vivre aujourd'hui, donc, l'ironie a fait que le jour de la sortie de la traduction en français, il y avait aussi ce livre de Norman Adjari qui est sorti, qui s'appelle Technofascisme. Donc qui explique aussi voilà, la séquence qu'on est en train de vivre là avec voilà, une sorte d'idéologie, cette espèce de conscience de classe là, des élites qui sont en plein pouvoir en fait, et qui sont en train de discuter avec les personnes qui sont chefs de gouvernement, qui sont aujourd'hui en train de poser des bombes partout. Voilà, cette situation en fait elle est là. Et elle vient profondément aussi de cette méconnaissance, en fait, ce grand flou, toujours aujourd'hui, qui nous habite sur bah, qu'est-ce que c'est, en fait, cette question de l'innovation technologique. Qui produit la technologie? Quelle est sa matérialité? Quelle est sa situation géopolitique? Et toutes ces questions, en fait, sont toujours en fait, des points aveugles, en fait, dans nos imaginaires juste communs. Donc, ce livre est extrêmement utile pour comprendre aussi cette situation, à la fois historique et aussi, voilà, qu'est-ce que ça signifie dans nos relations mondaines, enfin, tous les jours, quoi. Et voilà, et dans la préface, du coup, j'ai fait ce parallèle qui était évident, en fait, où il y a, donc, Zeros plus Ones, d'un côté, ce livre iconique, important, que vous devez lire. Et de l'autre côté, on a ce livre de Peter Thiel, donc, qui est le fondateur de Palantir. Palantir, donc l'entreprise de surveillance, enfin, de big data, de la surveillance, on va dire, qui a des contrats avec de nombreux États occidentaux, qui œuvrent vraiment pour le maintien de la suprématie occidentale. Enfin, c'est vraiment clairement dit comme ça. Si vous regardez les tweets, les publicités, tout ce que vous voulez, c'est très clair. Et donc, Peter Thiel a donc sorti un livre en 2014 qui s'appelle « Zero to One ». Et donc, ça crève les yeux, quoi. Enfin, il y a comme ça, voilà, une contre-proposition. Celle-ci est traduite en 2 ans en français. Alors que nous, enfin, vraiment, j'ai honte de voir à quel point... Enfin, ça a pris du temps. 30 ans, c'est beaucoup trop. C'est horrible. Donc, traduisez, s'il vous plaît, des livres qui sont importants. Et voilà, et dedans, il dit tout, en fait, c'est-à-dire que le zéro n'existe pas, c'est-à-dire le zéro, c'est rien, et on doit passer à l'action, et l'homme, c'est l'un, et tout repose sur cette mise en action d'une mission presque divine, héritée de la suprématie blanche, en fait. Donc, voilà, c'est là où on est aujourd'hui, et on doit absolument avoir des outils pour démonter cette histoire qui est majoritaire. Et je pense que ce livre est une pierre à cet édifice, quoi, à cette œuvre que nous devons faire. Donc voilà.
Oui, bah merci beaucoup pour ta préface qui vraiment effectivement remet le livre en perspective avec l'actualité brûlante. Moi, je me suis occupée du coup de la postface qui avait peut-être une dimension un peu plus à la fois pédagogique, puis qui faisait aussi un peu plus le lien peut-être avec certains concept philosophique, à la fois de la tradition philosophique et puis la tradition vraiment enfin, de ce qui se produit aujourd'hui en philosophie de très intéressant et qui parfois se réclame de Sadie Plante. Donc je voulais vraiment mettre ça en valeur. Moi, j'ai connu le livre de Sadie Plante alors que je travaillais justement sur la... Alors ça peut paraître surprenant, mais sur la philosophie allemande, l'idéalisme allemand, la philosophie de la nature allemande et puis le post-structuralisme. Ça paraît plus évident comme référence, mais donc je le dis parce que je pense qu'il y a aussi cette matrice un petit peu allemande qui énerve les textes du CCRU. En tout cas, je l'ai repéré dans plusieurs ouvrages de plusieurs auteurs. Donc, je pense que ça peut être intéressant de garder ça aussi en tête. C'est une autre clé de lecture. Et donc, j'ai été impressionnée, pareil, par la liberté de ton, en fait. C'était extrêmement rafraîchissant aussi, puisque j'ai rencontré ce texte juste après avoir fini ma thèse. Et il y avait quelque chose de très libérateur dans cette manière d'écrire, on va dire. Et puis, j'ai trouvé ça voilà, incroyable, la manière dont elle liait, en fait, les questions liées à la révolution digitale avec la dimension féministe et puis avec la question du tissage qui me préoccupait aussi beaucoup. Et j'avais rarement trouvé un ouvrage qui redonnait autant de dignité, en fait, à cette pratique technique et artistique qui connaît une sorte de revival aujourd'hui dans les pratiques curatoriales, dans les expositions, mais qui a mis aussi du temps à retrouver sa dignité dans le monde de l'art. Et donc, moi, j'avais travaillé sur Annie Albers, qui est exposée en ce moment, d'ailleurs, je crois encore à Berne. Et en fait, en lisant le livre de Sadie Plante, après avoir travaillé sur Annie Albers, j'ai vraiment trouvé qu'il y avait un dialogue magnifique qui pouvait se jouer entre les deux. Donc ça, je l'ai un petit peu expliqué dans la postface. Et donc l'idée de la postface, c'était un peu, oui, pédagogique, on va dire. C'était aussi un peu ce qui avait été demandé par Sans Soleil. C'était à la fois présenter donc, le CCRU, parce qu'on commence à le redécouvrir grâce à, grâce à vos initiatives, en tout cas dans le monde francophone. Et je m'en réjouis vraiment, parce que je pense que c'est un des laboratoires les plus puissants en termes de production de concepts pour penser notre contemporain et puis le futur dans ses versants obscurs comme lumineux. Donc je présente un peu le CCRU, le contexte d'écriture, les débuts du net, les balbutiements de l'informatique quantique qui est déjà très présente pour l'époque dans ton livre, c'est incroyable. Et j'essaye de mettre ça aussi un petit peu en dialogue avec l'afrofuturisme qui émerge au même moment. Donc j'ai un peu l'impression que c'est le pendant féministe de ce qu'essayent de faire les afrofuturistes. Donc je pense que ça peut être bien de mettre les deux mouvements en dialogue, on va dire, quand on lit le livre. Et puis pareil, j'ai beaucoup insisté sur la forme parce que, comme tu le disais, c'est vraiment ce qui est très réjouissant. Et je pense que le livre, il essaye vraiment de performer en fait aussi les thèses. J'ai même pas envie d'appeler ça des thèses, mais en tout cas ce qui est véhiculé, on va dire, ce qui est plutôt rare dans de la théorie, en tout cas dans de la philo. Et donc il y a vraiment ce côté un peu lien hypertexte. Il appelle le format numérique en fait ton livre. Et donc, il appelle vraiment une navigation personnelle de chaque lecteur et lectrice, en fait, qui va pouvoir vraiment naviguer à sa manière. Moi, il y a des points qui m'ont parlé et c'est comme ça que j'ai construit ma postface. Mais c'est sûr que chacun pourra se saisir, en fait, complètement d'autres entrées. Et moi, je vois vraiment ce livre comme un projet en open source où, justement, chacun est libre, en fait, de le prolonger, le continuer, le disséminer. Et donc, ça, c'était le dernier point. But, on va dire, de la postface, c'était de nommer, et sans du tout que ce soit exhaustif, mais un certain nombre de projets théoriques contemporains qui, pour moi, se situent dans cet appel à la prolongation et à l'enrichissement du projet. Donc, je parle du manifeste xénoféministe, de certaines autrices issues des nouveaux matérialismes. Et donc, tout ça, c'est juste, en fait, des débuts d'encouragement pour que chacun... tisse en fait sa lecture dans ce livre et aille chercher aussi ailleurs dans des zones extra-textuelles en fait sa compréhension de cet ouvrage extrêmement riche. Voilà.
Est-ce que tu as des réactions ou est-ce que j'ai une
question? Ouais, peut-être je peux dire c'était l'idée. Voudrais pousser quoi c'est possible dans les limites d'un livre. Mm. Un livre, c'est bien sûr très linéaire, mais c'était mon défi.
Et on voit que ça appelle une autre forme, en fait. Mm-hmm. Ouais.
Mm-hmm. Alors moi, j'ai une question, parce qu'on parle beaucoup de ce CCRU, donc c'est Cybernetic Culture Research Unit. Mm-hmm. Et en fait, c'est un peu mystérieux ce que c'est. Enfin, moi, j'ai trouvé une liste de centres d'intérêt, et c'est le cinéma, la complexité, les devises, la dance music, le e-cash, le cryptage, le féminisme, la fiction, les images, la vie inorganique, la jungle, les marchés, les matrices, les microbiotiques, le multimédia, les réseaux, les chiffres, la perception, la réplication, le sexe, la simulation, le son, les télécommunications, les textiles, les textes, le commerce, la vidéo, la virtualité, la bon, voilà. En fait, c'est quoi? Est-ce que on peut savoir ce que vous faisiez vraiment et concrètement, comment ça se passait, comment ça s'est fait? Parce que c'est toi qui l'a lancé et du coup près de gens et peut-être nous parler un peu aussi de cet écosystème qui était peut-être le terreau pour les cours d'essai, ou c'était avant ou après, peut-être vous expliquer un peu parce que ça a l'air très mystérieux.
It's you know, it's become this kind of legendary almost mythological thing, which is, you know, yeah, of course absurd when you are involved in something like that and these stories become get spun around it. But yeah, it was, on the one hand, there was a group of people in a philosophy department at one university, and there was another group of people in a cultural studies department in a second university, and I was part of the latter. And these two groups kind of met each other and, you know, had a lot of Well, I wouldn't say at first common interests, and certainly not all those interests that you list, but nevertheless, interests that they felt were not really satisfied either in cultural studies, which was a very, you know, kind of sociological type of field, or in philosophy, which was really, I think, in the 1990s, probably like a lot of theoretical disciplines, it was a bit caught in this kind of postmodern, nothing's happening, there's nothing more to say, you know, end of history kind of atmosphere. And of course in my department in the university, I was teaching in this cultural studies department, I remember us getting the first computers. They didn't even have hard drives, you know, you had to put in a floppy disk to even set it up. I wish I'd have kept mine, it was a little Apple this big. But, you know, I mean, it really was this, I mean, it sounds silly now, but, you know, it was this magical kind of time of thinking, wow, what is that? And, you know, you can plug it in, you can, you know, of course, there was no browser system. I mean, we really are talking before the World Wide Web was even thought of. But, you know, of course, you could contact people on the other side of the world at 3 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, you imagine at a time when that wasn't possible and you could suddenly do that. It was obviously, we thought it was a revolutionary, which it was, you know, but nobody really seemed to be kind of noticing that this was happening in our kind of academic fields. And of course, you know, philosophy was full of discussion from the previous 20 plus years about anti-humanism and, you know, what is the subject, the death of the author, this kind of, you know, theoretical discussion. Questions about originality and so on. You know, it was all very much present in theory, but somehow the connections with the technology just weren't made. So I suppose, yeah, that's what was the kind of really exciting part of this moment, was to, yeah, see what happened when you did put these things together. And then, of course, it did almost automatically lead to this great list, which, you know, partly I guess that is a bit also from me. I mean, I'd already kind of been in trouble with the university because we had to, for example, once fill in a form with, it said, name your research interests. And it was like this big, the thing, you know, I said, maximum three, you know, and I just thought, I am really in the wrong, I'm in the wrong place here. Yeah, so, you know, it always seemed to me that, of course, you know, there's an endless list of things to be interested in, and especially to see how they all interconnect. But suddenly there really was like a good reason to do that. You know, the so-called digital revolution really did have an impact across all of these fields. Yeah, right from cinema to microbiology and all the other things you had on the list. Yeah, so that's the kind of, you know, the less romantic and less kind of giddy version of how it started.
Je me demandais comment ça avait été reçu le livre à l'époque, comment c'était, parce que je sais qu'il a eu, j'ai cru comprendre qu'il avait eu beaucoup de succès tout de suite, mm-hmm. lot of success, mm-hmm. Et que ça a propulsé aussi, ça a propulsé comme une sorte de figure, peut-être même...
Yeah.
Ça le féministe, peut-être j'ai même vu dans un entretien que tu disais que c'était même pas quelque chose que tu te nommais toi-même ça le féministe, mais que c'est quelque chose qu'on t'a recollé. Mm-hmm. Et peut-être comprendre qu'est-ce qui s'est passé en fait à cette sortie et comment ça s'est passé quoi. Si tu pouvais peut-être le décrire.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I probably the sort of regretful thing about it was that I hadn't long before published another book about the Situationists, and, you know, probably politically and in many, you know, other ways too. That is my kind of starting point, and it's the point I am still coming back to, actually. So it was a bit hard for me that this book kind of got completely ignored and kind of swept aside in this whole excitement about so-called cyberfeminism. Yeah. And of course, as soon as there is an ism attached to anything, I mean, it's the same with the Situationists, you know, who I have always refused to use the word situationism. And then of course came cyberfeminism. Yeah. There's a strange connection with Arabic, because this isma means name, you know, it's like giving things a name, give it a stamp. Yeah. And yeah, being propelled into this role. I mean, even sitting here, you know, it's really one of my. I mean, it's lovely to be here, don't you? It's also one of my least favourite things to do, you know. Yeah. No. I mean, it's not that bad, but yeah, it's not. I mean, you know, on a serious level, maybe it is actually still a bit something we should notice about our culture. You know, I thought today when, you know, I spent like half an hour with this guy taking my photograph, you know, I think really, you know, you've written all this stuff about, you know, against the spectacle, against individuality, against this kind of focus on, you know, the star, and you just can't escape this system. Yeah, so it's not only the technological systems we can't escape, there's a lot of cultural systems that are difficult to escape.
Peut-être pour rebondir là-dessus, j'ai une question. Justement, le livre a cette manière d'agréger énormément de voix différentes et de performer, comme tu disais, le fait qu'on pense absolument pas seul, mais toujours avec d'autres voix qui nous ont précédés, qui nous accompagnent. Mmh. Et j'aimerais revenir un peu sur la manière que tu as eu d'écrire ce livre, parce que voilà, sa forme est vraiment très étonnante. Et donc, j'aurais juste voulu savoir voilà, comment vraiment matériellement tu as écrit. Est-ce que ça t'a pris du temps? Est-ce que tu as commencé au milieu? Est-ce que tu as commencé au début? Qu'est-ce que... si tu t'en souviens.
Some of this I really can't remember, you know. So that's a not very helpful answer. I mean, part of the story, I guess, is that I was asked to write this book by a publisher. Mm. Of course, that's always a really, you know, on the one hand, a great thing to happen to any writer. Of course, as you can imagine, also, then it's this big pressure, there is a deadline, there is time, and me and deadlines, you know, we're really not such good friends. And, and of course, I also felt I had then, by this point, quite a lot of pressure from my colleagues in this cybernetic culture research unit who, you know, really, I think, saw their chance for a lot of their ideas to kind of come out through my writing, if we could put it that way. There were, you know, several sort of pressures that I was eager to avoid. Mm. And I think, I think it didn't actually take so long to write. You know, probably of course, there was a lot of, you know, there was a few years of thinking and maybe like 2 years of writing, I would say. And in those 2 years, that was also the kind of these 2 years that this unit existed. And, you know, by the time I finished it, I was already leaving this unit. Yeah, I think I really, you know, maybe even actually in the course of writing the book, kind of saw where I felt it was really heading in some like directions which didn't interest me, didn't kind of satisfy me even aesthetically, and I also thought were really politically going to be going in some bad places, which did turn out to be the case.
Yeah.
And they really also, of course, I did, you know, it was a bit hard for me that, you know, of course, some of my colleagues, especially the dear and sorely missed Mark Fisher, you know, they really didn't like the book. They felt, you know, it wasn't, oh, well, I mean, I'm not going to start speaking for other people, but it didn't satisfy them.
Peut-être si on va dans le contenu du livre, comme tu l'avais dit, c'est dans plein de sections, et dans chacune de ces sections, il y a vraiment deux livres qui reviennent beaucoup, qui sont deux livres de science-fiction qui sont écrits par deux femmes. Donc l'un, c'est Pat Katkin, qui est une autrice de science-fiction américaine, états-unienne, et Monique Wittig, qui est du coup une romancière, philosophe, théoricienne et militante féministe lesbienne. Donc le premier livre de Pat Katkin, c'est Les Saintes Hérétiques. Et l'autre, c'est Les Guerrières. Mm-hmm. Et vraiment, ça ponctue. On a l'impression de lire ces trois livres en même temps. Il y a aussi plein d'autres citations de Ada Lovelace et de ses journaux, je pense. Et du coup, pourquoi ces livres, pourquoi ils étaient importants et pourquoi ils sont autant présents dans la narration Et peut-être qu'est-ce que c'est, qui c'était ces gens pour à cette époque, enfin, parce que maintenant Benigbitig a vraiment un retour de visibilité, pas de quelqu'un, pas trop. Mm-hmm. Et
I suppose I just felt these were texts, or at least the part of the text that I used, like others in the book. You know, it is a bit of a collage with lots and lots of quotations, and in this sense it's a, you know, sort of without permission, a sort of collectively written sort of book in a way. I guess I felt these books really, these texts added something. I mean, Monique Wittig, I really still really love. I think she's a very important writer, and something about the kind of, you know, passion or even anger that she wrote with, I think is really, yeah, commendable and often missing today. I mean, you know, it's quite funny, since I, you know, I'm now, you know, with a partner and three kids, you know, but people have often said to me, you know, it is kind of, in a philosophical way at least, a sort of lesbian philosophy in this book, because it is talking about this relations on between this kind of materiality, a kind of horizontality amongst these kind of female forces, if you like. So yeah, maybe that's why Wittig's voice is very present in it. Just on Pat Cadigan, I mean, I always thought she was a really good and kind of neglected contemporary of people like William Gibson, you know, and a more well-known kind of cyberpunk writer. So, and I did meet her a couple of times through the CCRU. She was invited to come and talk and so on. So, yeah, that was connection with her.
Oui, je voulais peut-être revenir justement sur le préambule ou le prologue qu'on a lu tout à l'heure, qui est vraiment magnifique, et où justement il y a un petit peu cette dimension. On a l'impression d'un début de livre de science-fiction qui s'arrête quand même vite, mais il y a vraiment ce ton. On dirait aussi, au début, je me suis dit qu'on aurait presque dit aussi une sorte de réécriture de certains passages de la Bible, mais d'une manière effectivement... Non, mais d'une manière extrêmement... Non, mais il y a quelque chose de très prophétique, en fait, dans ce préambule. Mm-hmm. Et en fait, il y a ce qui est très fort dans ce préambule, c'est l'imaginaire quantique. Et ça ouvre le livre et ça clôt le livre aussi. Donc je me demande ce qui, justement... Enfin, à l'époque, quel était, justement, l'espoir suscité par cet imaginaire qui se retrouve chez Karen Barat, par exemple. Enfin, quel était l'espoir suscité par cet imaginaire, puisque tu as l'air de le proposer en dépassement de, justement, la matrice mécaniste sur laquelle reposent les techniques digitales, l'époque où tu écris. Donc, quelle était l'importance de cet imaginaire?
Yeah, I mean, this is still coming, isn't it? It's like automation, like the end of work, you know, quantum computing is also still coming, as it was still coming 30 years ago, like a lot of other things. Of course, I mean, my, you know, technical knowledge of quantum mechanics is probably, you know, on the par of most people's, and then especially, obviously, this idea of a quantum computer really was almost kind of science fiction, although a real proposition. But of course, it kind of fits with the whole direction of the book, really, to suggest that, you know, although the whole digital developments seemed in some ways, you know, extremely innovative and radically different, it was in fact just constantly circling around and reinforcing these very well-established and old mechanistic mindsets, and in the computing terms, you know, doing so quite technically as well. And of course that has really, you know, it's changed and it's not changed. In some ways, you could say, you know, you can look at the old computer of the 1990s and you see it has this very, you know, it has this central processing unit. It's very, you know, this kind of centralized, discrete, singular thing. on the other hand, you can look at that period and see, you know, the internet as this, you know, relative to what it is now, a very decentralized and chaotic kind of horizontal system. By the same token, now, of course, you know, computing, yeah, does begin to move into a much more, or has moved into a much more decentralized way of working, and then with the prospect of quantum computing, yeah, of course, even more so. On the other hand, the other side, the internet has become more and more kind of, well, we can't really say centralized, but concentrated around a few kind of central nodes in a more and more of a kind of shopping mall kind of experience. But I think, you know, I mean, maybe, yeah, I don't know, but I suspect that, you know, what's happening time and again over the last 30 years with each of these stages is that, of course, the computing power gets greater, things get faster. I mean, computing is largely a matter of speed, I think, and this again will happen with quantum computing. It will be like the same, only faster, you know, and the idea that there is this kind of, you know, really qualitative leap then that will come, I suspect that won't happen. And the same with artificial intelligence. You know, I think it's just that there's this desire to pour more and more information into it and more money into it, in with the idea that it will kind of switch into some other level. But I also doubt that.
Moi, je vais un peu changer de sujet. Je voulais parler de Jam the Quake, qui est un concept qui arrive dans chapitre. Qui s'appelle, qui a été traduit par tremblement de champ. Et je voulais savoir un peu ce que c'est et peut-être comment ça résonne avec. Parce qu'en fait, il y a une partie aussi tout vers la fin où tu parles beaucoup des questions transgenres et, voilà, et toutes ces choses-là. Et je me demandais comment la panique trans actuelle résonne avec ce concept de gender break et peut-être. Voilà comment. Enfin, c'était aussi, je pense, très rare d'avoir des livres qui parlaient de ces questions-là, en tout cas, qui étaient autant mainstream. Et voilà, peut-être me parler un peu de ces questions-là que tu abordes déjà.
Yeah, I think it's almost a similar question with, you know, the quantum decentralized direction on the one hand of things, on the other, this, you know, radically centralizing tendencies, and we see the same thing happening in terms of gender and sexuality and all sorts of social relations. You know, on the one hand, things are really moving in fast and interesting ways. You know, the very fact that we can even, you know, have these words of trans and non-binary, I mean, non-binary, you know, that it's even a kind of mainstream term in this context is kind of quite amazing, isn't it? And on the other hand, yeah, of course, we have this reaction, literally, you know, the backlash against that. That's probably, you know, it's broadly speaking, explains a lot of the things that are happening now, doesn't it? It's, you know, we sort of pay the price for the success in many ways with a kind of backlash or a reaction against these developments.
J'ai une question, je me demandais ce que le groupe dans lequel vous évoluez, comment est-ce qu'il s'est développé en fait? Est-ce qu'il existe encore ou est-ce qu'il a...
I mean, honestly, after I kind of parted company in like 1997, I never had any contact with any of these people again, except for a couple of years ago, then reconnecting with one or two of them. Yeah, so I mean, it did carry on. It then I think without, you know, I think probably at the time that I left, they regarded me as a bit of as kind of holding things back. You know, they wanted to really go off into this occult, what to me kind of quasi-fascist direction. And and they did do that, you know, pretty much, I would say, yeah. I mean, not all to the same degree of, you know, awareness and complicity with that, but I would say essentially that's kind of the direction it started to go in. And Nick Land in particular, who was the co-founder of this, I mean, you may know this name, you know, he's a well-known, outspoken, well, what should we say, you know, alt-right, technically, but, you know, yeah, bigger. So, yeah. And I think even after it sort of disbanded, I mean, yeah, as I say, I kind of just really looked away, turned away from it completely. But when I did kind of look back a few years later, you know, I realized it had at some point disbanded around the turn of the century. You know, I think there were various kind of crises that happened amongst the people involved. And then it had a kind of ongoing life online, which possibly it still does have, but I actually haven't looked for ages.
Mais du coup, ces idées, tu sentais qu'elles étaient déjà un peu présentes dans les discussions et que c'était ça qui a créé finalement des clashs à l'intérieur, qui ont fait que, par exemple, les gens partent. Enfin, est-ce que c'est vraiment. Voilà, ton problème.
You know, it's very difficult to say, isn't it? It's always hard to know when you look back on things, you know, what was already present, how clear it was where things were positioned at the time, what was overlooked, you know, what did one later become aware of? It's, you know, retrospectively, it's easy to say, oh, yeah, you know, should have seen that coming, or, you know, clearly that was a bit strange, or, yeah. It's, you know, maybe it's not unlike, I sometimes think it's a bit like, you know, you can look at Stalinism, say, and then you say, you know, were the seeds of the errors already there in Marx? Or, yeah, I mean, yes and no, isn't it? It's hard, it's difficult to kind of really put your finger on it. But I think, I mean, this thing that I said earlier about inevitability, you know, I think that was, I suppose in Zeros and Ones, I kind of use this as a kind of this vaguely threatening tone, you know, to power, to sort of suggest that things may not kind of always go their way as a device, you know, it's like, and I think it does have a real power, and probably in lots of political moments, you know, one does need to say, you know, we will win, you know, even if actually in your heart you think, well, you know, maybe, but it's an important strategy. It's it does really matter to say that at certain times, but at the same time, you know, I think there were many people involved in this in CCIU at the time who, you know, really were inside this story in a way that I wasn't. You know, area that's I would hesitate to say between theory and fiction, because this kind of theory fiction has almost become a genre in itself, and I also have problems with that actually. But nevertheless, you know, a kind of more imaginative way of writing about things which are normally only written about in like more academic, you know, theoretical ways. That's still, I think, really, you know, lovely to read when you find it in other people, and still what I like to try to write.
I have a very simple one. So thanks a lot to everyone for this beautiful conversation. When your book came out, you were mentioning before that your first book was about the international situationist. Mm-hmm. And from the 90s, it made perfect sense that mm-hmm. after the international situationist, you would write this book. Because somehow it was also in the pre-internet mindset, mm-hmm. And possibly also in the approach to writing, there was something of this non-linear approach to mm-hmm. writing that was happening still in an analog way.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. It was like a comment or an open question, but I remember I printed your book and the commentaries on the Society Spectacle from a bulletin board system.
Mm.
So I found it afterwards.
Yeah.
But the first version was a pilot.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you if mm-hmm. it also made sense for you at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish I could honestly say it made the kind of sense you've just told it with, but yeah, I think for me, it wasn't quite so easy to see how these things went. Well, yeah, no, maybe that's not really true. I think Maybe I saw that they went together, but I think a lot of people in the CCRU, you know, the thing about the situation is that they have this kind of Hegelian philosophical underpinning, and Hegelian thinking with its contradictions and its kind of resolutions and its supposed idealism was like exactly the opposite to what a lot of people in the CCRU, especially Nick Land, were interested in. And so, it was a bit of a struggle to kind of really maintain anybody's or get anybody interested in my interest in the situation. And I kind of, maybe I should have fought for that a bit harder, really. But of course, you know, it had this, you know, the situation is fed very much into punk in the English context. It had then this DIY photocopying, making pamphlets. Of course, this led very, very smoothly into hacking culture. And yeah, it does all, you know, looking back at some of these cases retrospectively, it kind of does all fit and work together. Yeah.
Peut-être qu'on peut rebondir sur le troisième livre qui est Writing on Drugs, qui est vraiment une continuité, je dirais, d'après, et comment peut-être peut-être les liens entre ces trois livres, ce livre et...
I mean, of course, you know, this was the time, especially around the CCRU, there was, you know, quite a lot of writing on drugs happening. But that's not the reason why I wrote this book. I mean, for many years before that, I'd been very interested in this topic, and I always thought it was one of these subjects that, of course, there are a lot of books about psychoactive substances, but either they still now even, you know, they tend to be very dry academic kind of studies, which you feel, you know, don't quite appreciate the true interest. Or else, you know, of course, they're written by people who've taken too many drugs, and yeah, they obviously that also brings its problems. And I thought it would be really great to, you know, try to write a book that was a bit between these two, or was neither of these two. I always had the idea that Michel Foucault, who I still really love as a thinker, actually, that this was the, not my book, but I mean, it was a topic that he never addressed. It was the book he never wrote, you know, because of course he wrote about all the topics around it, you know, illegality, medicine, madness, you know, but not quite the topic itself. And also, I had the idea at first, this really is going to sound overambitious and kind of a bit silly, probably as a thought, but originally in my mind, I kind of had the idea of zeros and ones and the later book that I wrote about drugs almost being one big book. Because, and the kind of the point of, or how they kind of came together, well, there's several ways, but one of them was the figure of Ada Lovelace, because she, you know, of course, is a big figure in Zeros and Ones as the world's first computer programmer, in effect. But she was also a big opium user. And, you know, a lot of her letters are really describing her opium use and so on. So I thought, you know, it's really a way of thinking about the hardware of the computer that she worked on with Charles Babbage, the software that she actually herself was writing, but also the kind of the wetware inside, you know, it's like the third element. But this was obviously a ridiculous, overambitious idea, so it became two quite distinct books in the end. But I think there are a lot of interesting parallels. I mean, I often think now, if you look at ChatGPT and our own behavior with social media, you know, we have this vocabulary about hallucination on the one hand with ChatGPT or the large language model, which of course you can say, actually, you know, this is a very overblown term because it's just getting things wrong, but we can't say that, so we say it's hallucinating. But yeah, you sort of know what we mean by that. It's a very interesting kind of thought. And on the other hand, yeah, there is our kind of dependency, our addiction to the phone, to a large extent. And it is, you know, sometimes I think, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but if you do start looking and you walk around or you sit on the train and, you know, you see how much we are all sitting, eyes down, you know, I do sometimes really get this urge to, you know, throw my phone out of the window and say to everybody, look around, you know. And I do think it is part of our current problem that we're not actually looking around us and seeing what's going on. You know, it's, yeah, and of course it's very difficult to say that without then sounding, you know, just like a old technophobic person. I mean, I am old, but I'm of course not technophobic. But
mais ce qui m'avait aussi frappé aussi, c'était the conspiracy, de like, quand l'État aussi prend les drogues et les utilise pour, pour calmer les troupes. Enfin, voilà, et quand, yeah. C'était vraiment des trucs qui m'avaient.
No, that's very scary.
Par rapport au téléphone, il y a des choses comme on est dressé par les addictions qui sont.
Yeah, yeah, there was an article just last week in the Watts, actually, about exactly this topic of, you know, now a lot of the companies in the States which are investing in psychedelic research and so on are being now bought by the same far-right corporate players that we know so well. They're the people who are investing in this kind of research, you know, and it's another kind of twist, isn't it? This psychedelic culture that, say, in the 1960s, 70s, even 90s, to some extent, was such a kind of, you know, what regarded as so creative and productive and radical and subversive, and yeah, now gets bought up by these players on the right. That is, you know, kind of quite a, well, it's something to look out for, isn't it? Yeah.
Thank you. So I know now you are working more on pedagogy and like writing about pedagogy as well. And how do you think you still absorb these ideas in your writing today? And how?
Which ideas that what we've been talking about? Yeah, I mean, this topic of pedagogy, of course, I do some teaching in the Arkabe in Bern, but I honestly wouldn't really say, as you've just said, that I'm, you know, I have just written a small text about the relationship between kindergarten and art school, actually, you know, but I mean, it's a small thing. And the bigger project that I mentioned earlier, you know, that does definitely have a bearing on a lot of the things that we're talking about now. Yeah. Yeah. But I haven't finished that yet, unfortunately. Mm. I think it, you know, sometimes I thought maybe it isn't even a book, perhaps it should be like a film or an exhibition or, something else. But I think it will be a book, and it will kind of cover a lot of these philosophical issues in a non-academic way, and it will have pictures as well. It's my new challenge to write a philosophy book that is accessible for people who can't read. And I have actually just, if I can just show this to you, a few years ago, I did my very first kind of artwork, thanks to an invitation. Yeah, hopefully it won't be the last. It was an installation in Biel, it's like the off space of an off space. And it's called The Secret Space, Le Lieu Secret. And it's curated by Florence Jung, who you maybe know, and Emily Gwenner. Anyway, they asked me to do something in this vitrine, which was, I say vitrine, it's that's a bit grand. It's an old telephone kiosk. And I made it into a place that looks like you can take a book or leave a book, you know, one of these free book places. I think there's one just around the corner here somewhere. But then you couldn't enter it. And when you looked at it closely, if you looked at it closely, you saw that the books were arranged very, very carefully. I mean, millimeter exact, with their titles lined up underneath each other. So they were placed horizontally, and each pile of books makes a poem. And it had a QR code on the door, and you could scan the QR code, and then you saw the poems as text, and then you could kind of read them on the phone and see them in the space. And of course, this was very much a project about books on the one hand, so I always thought it would be great to turn it into a book. And not long ago, this book was published by Spectre Books, which has a few photos of the installation. It has the poems themselves kind of written as poems. I call them poems. Actually, I did do a little book launch in Zurich, and somebody in the audience said, "What makes you think they're poems?" Whoa, okay. They are poems. And they're kind of, written as poems. And they're multilingual, partly because Biel, of course, is such a multilingual city. And then they're also, you can also see, they're not photographs, but they're actually scans of the book spines, so you can actually read them in their original form, as it were, as images in the book. So it's like it's like several takes on the same project. And as I say, it's partly about books, but it's also, not totally irrelevant to our discussion today, because maybe it is trying to sort of just suggest to people that there are like little snippets of magic around us. Two books on the shelf do actually make a two-line poem, and anybody can do it. You can do it with your own bookshelves. And then of course it just kind of tunes you in a little bit to all of the text and all of the other things that are around in the world. So it's a very small gesture, but as you probably can get, as you probably realise, I think it's actually in these relatively small gestures that a lot of things can happen.
Perfect.